This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
We are now starting to deal with the sponsors, the kingpins. My message to this syndicate is they should watch out. Malawi is no longer a playground. We'll eventually get to them, so they better stop.
That was Malawi prosecutor Andy Koanga saying wildlife traffickers should take the convictions of a gang as a warning that officials are serious about cracking down on them. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. 20 years after 9/11 and the start of the war on terrorism, jihad terrorism is rising in Africa, where violent groups are thriving and in some cases expanding across borders. Islamist insurgencies in Africa have three main geographical areas of operation: Somalia, the Sahel region of West Africa, and the area around Lake Chad and northeast Nigeria, from where the conflict directly impacts northern Cameroon, Chad, and Niger. Emily Steele, a research associate at American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, discussed the reasons behind this rise with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
To understand how this situation developed, where we've got established Salafi jihadi insurgencies across several regions of Africa, we have to look both at the dynamics that led to this situation and the shortcomings in the policy response. So on the causes, we've seen both systemic and acute governance failures that have allowed Salafi jihadi groups to gain footholds. Unfortunately, several governments have not been able to overcome the serious challenges that have prevented them from providing services and security to their entire populations. So if you look at the challenges faced by the Somali government or the Mali government, for example, on the policy response, though, it's clear that a security-forward approach to counterterrorism has not been enough. This approach might win short-term military gains against Salafi jihadi groups and even severely weaken these groups. But the piece that's missing is the governance and development that will actually change the conditions and stop the groups from coming back.
The very rapid fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban is bringing back the nightmarish thought that global jihadi terrorist groups will again find a safe haven where they can reorganize and thrive. It also draws attention to Africa, where jihadi groups have been on the rise. How could the fall of Afghanistan embolden the terrorist groups in Africa?
The Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan is a potential jolt to African Salafi jihadi groups. It's a sign that the strategy that, say, Al-Shabaab in Somalia or JNIM in Mali, it's a sign that their strategies are working. And these groups are already drawing comparisons between themselves and the Taliban. And they'll be only more emboldened now to pressure local governments. They'll also take this as proof positive that the U.S. and other external players can be pushed out over time. Another potential outcome is kind of increasing the competition between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State as those organizations jockey for leadership of the global movement. That competition can be misleading, though, because it can reduce attacks on other targets initially by turning the groups against each other, but it can also encourage Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State to conduct larger terror attacks to try and outbid each other for recruits.
Are these jihadi groups in Africa really affiliated with Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State group?
Yes, to varying degrees. So, for example, if you look at Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Al-Shabaab has been a formal Al-Qaeda affiliate for quite some time now and had an ongoing relationship before that and has gained some of the capabilities it has from other Al-Qaeda groups, for example. There are other organizations that are more loosely connected. Some of the groups in the Sahel, for example, you know, operate at a little bit more distance, but they still kind of follow Al-Qaeda's strategic vision and support the overall agenda. Likewise, for the Islamic State, there's a range of how closely tied various affiliates are to leadership. So the Islamic State West Africa province in Nigeria has been shown to have fairly close ties to Islamic State leadership, whereas some of the groups now active in Eastern and Central Africa are connected through an organizational structure and have received some support, but are generally operating more on their own.
Hopefully, the United States and its allies will be able to reflect on some of the lessons learned in Afghanistan and apply them as they approach their fights against jihadi insurrections in Africa. What could happen if Western nations start seriously cutting their support to African governments in their quest to combat terrorist groups in Africa?
So the Afghanistan experience should teach us about the value of a relatively small footprint in preventing worst case scenarios. And so the risk here is that a rapid drawdown in any of these other theaters could also produce a scenario where Salafi jihadi groups gain a lot of strength very quickly. So while the U.S. absolutely needs to review its counterterrorism approach, it should keep up the light footprint approach for African security forces while doing so. For example, there was a long pause in U.S. airstrikes in Somalia earlier this year, and we did see a growth in al-Shabaab activity and spread into additional areas during that time. So sustaining the pressure does matter. But the U.S. should be looking to reform its approach to prioritize governance-forward solutions and conflict resolution, and using the security piece to buy time and space for these other solutions to take hold and hopefully have a more long-term effect.
That was Emily Estill, a research associate at American Enterprise Institute's Critical Threats Project, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawy. 30 international and local organizations recently issued an open letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and permanent representatives of the Security Council, asking them to take urgent action to end violence and farming in Tigray. Hardin Lang is Vice President of Refugees International, one of the organizations that signed the letter. VOA's Jackson Vunganyi reached him at his office in Washington, D.C., and asked him about the letter and what needs to be done to end the humanitarian crisis in the Tigray region.
And what we're trying to do is increase sort of the pressure and public awareness around the fact that this crisis inside of Tigray is continuing to degenerate, with the goal of putting real pressure on the United Nations Secretary General and perhaps more importantly, members of the Security Council to actually take more concrete action to get involved in the resolution of the crisis. In particular, what we're looking for is first a humanitarian ceasefire of some form. And that's not just the government of Ethiopia and forces allied with it, but that's also the Tigrayan defense forces, who are at the moment the ones who have the initiative on the battlefield, not only outside, right, immediately outside Tigray, but also in some of the surrounding regions. So we want to see all the parties sort of agree to a ceasefire. We want to see the Ethiopian government very quickly open up access of the blockade. So right now, since the blockade went into effect, the UN estimates that it's needed over about 8,000 trucks or so of aid to go in. That's about 100 trucks a day. So far in that period of time, last couple of months, we've seen about 400 plus trucks go through. So that gives you a feeling for how bad it is.
Right.
In addition, we want to see some humanitarian monitors deployed to be able to watch what's happening inside of Tigray and watch the aid being delivered and really encourage, finally, as a final step, more increased sort of an inclusive political process that will bring all the parties to the conflict to the table across Ethiopia.
And what kind of influence can the UN exert on the Ethiopian government to make them comply with these demands that you're making in this letter?
That's an excellent question. I mean, I think the pressure comes in a couple of different forms. The first thing is that the Security Council really needs to take ownership of this issue. And we're very pleased to see that for the first time, we believe that Ethiopia and the crisis in Ethiopia is going to appear formally on the calendar in October for discussion. And so we think that's going to move forward. We're also grateful to see that members of the Security Council and the Secretary General are increasingly beginning to use sort of more pointed rhetoric in talking about who is responsible. At the end of the day, the UN simply needs to hold to account the parties to the conflict and the government of Ethiopia. But then countries like the United States, which exert more direct pressure, need to work in concert, right, with the UN and the other members of the Security Council. And you see the United States coming out and doing some fairly strong things in recent weeks. For example, we've seen the U.S. put into place or establish the authority to exercise sanctions over individuals responsible for human rights abuse, atrocity, and then keeping humanitarian aid from flowing into areas where it's needed. Now, they haven't put those sanctions into effect yet. They simply said, the Biden administration simply said that they've got the authority to do it. And they say, if we don't see behavior change in a couple of key areas, they're going to put those into place. And so what needs to happen is those sanctions need to be married with a political strategy to get the various parties of the conflict to the table under the threat of sanction, but with the United Nations and the African Union convening to begin to look at sort of workable and concrete solutions to improve the situation on the ground.
That was Hardin Lang, Vice President of Refugees International. He spoke with my colleague, Jason Vunganyi, from his office in Washington. The head of the World Health Organization has apologized after a new report alleged rape and sexual abuse by workers sent to fight Ebola in the DRC. A special investigation identified 83 suspects, including 21 employed by the WHO. In releasing the report, WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called it, quote, a dark day, unquote, for the agency, and said the perpetrators would be brought to justice. He said two already have been placed on administrative leave, contracts have been terminated for four who will be banned from future employment at WHO, with the broader UN system to be notified of their actions. Independent investigators commissioned by the WHO cited, quote, clear structural failures, unquote, individual negligence, unquote. It said the majority of the alleged perpetrators were Congolese staff hired on a temporary basis who took advantage of their apparent authority to obtain sexual favors. Tedros admitted he had been to the country 14 times without anyone raising the matter and said he probably should have asked more questions. A Malawi magistrate's court in the capital, Lilongwe, has sentenced a Chinese national described by some as one of the biggest African wildlife trafficking kingpins to 22 years in prison after convicting him of three wildlife crimes. The court, however, said the sentences will run concurrently for 14 years and then there's a plan to deport him. But as Namek Masina reports from Blantyre, the convict is looking to appeal the sentence.
Judge Justice Violet Chipao on Tuesday sentenced Lin Hyun-hwa to 14 years in prison for trading in rhino horn, 14 years for possession of rhino horn, and an additional 6 years for money laundering. Justice Chipao, however, said the sentences will run concurrently, meaning that Lin will serve a total of 14 years. Lin, a Chinese national and the leader of wildlife trafficking syndicate, Ling Zhangang, named after the husband and wife leaders, has been operating out of Malawi for at least a decade. Malawi's authorities arrested him in August 2019 following a 3-month manhunt. Prosecution lawyer Ande Kawonga says Lin would face another punishment after completing the sentence.
Once he serves his sentence, I think our colleagues at the DPP office will probably take it with the Minister of Homeland Security, I think, and then start maybe the processes of his deportation, because the court has recommended that I think he should be deported from the country.
The sentencing of Lin brings the number of wildlife trafficking syndicate members sent to prison to 14. These include 4 Malawian and 10 Chinese nationals, including Lin's wife, currently 7 and 11-year prison term. Lin's daughter was also arrested in December 2020 for alleged money laundering offenses. Her trial is ongoing. Brighton Kunchedwa is Malawi's director of the Department of National Parks and Wildlife. He warned that the crackdown on the members of the Ling Zhangang should send a message to other wildlife trafficking syndicates.
We are now starting to deal with the sponsors, the kingpins. My message to these syndicates is they should watch out. Malawi is no longer a playground. We'll eventually get to them, so they better stop.
Kunchedwa says the crackdown is a result of new strategies the government put in place toward combating wildlife crimes.
From 2015 thereabout, we changed completely the game of handling wildlife crimes. So we used our own intelligence combined with police intelligence. We used also sniffer dogs in the process. So it's different strategies that I've seen us going this far.
Mary Rice is the executive director of the London-based Environmental Investigation Agency, an organization campaigning against environmental crimes and abuse. Speaking to VOA via a messaging app from London, Rice says the crackdown shows Malawi's commitment to bring high-level wildlife criminals to justice.
It was not an easy road, but the tenacity and the resilience of the investigators, the lawyers, and the judge, who made some very, very interesting comments in the sentencing, they are all to be applauded for their work. And we know there have been many, many obstacles along the way. So I think it's a great result.
Defense lawyer Crispin Dalama told VOA Tuesday his client is considering appealing against the sentence.
Of course, over the phone, the client indicated that he would want to appeal. But I will have to look at the judgment first, the sentence first, to see and understand the reasoning of the court so that I can advise my client properly as to whether we need to appeal or not.
Ndalama says he expected the court to give Lin a lesser sentence because he pleaded guilty to the charges of possession of wildlife products. The court has given the defense 30 days to appeal the sentence. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Tunisia's president has named the country's first female prime minister and told her to form a new cabinet as soon as possible, easing a two-month-old power gap at the upper echelons of government. Najla Boudin Ramadan, a 63-year-old professor at a prestigious engineering school who has World Bank experience, becomes one of the first women in the Arab world to hold such a senior position. However, it's unclear how much clout she will have as President Kais Saied has consolidated power amid plans to skirt the constitution and rule by a presidential decree. Saied fired Ramadan's predecessor and froze parliament on July 25th, saying the government has bungled the COVID-19 pandemic and sparked unrest over the country's financial problems. Critics call the move a coup that threatens Tunisia's young democracy. In South Africa, human rights and cultural groups are outraged after the education minister branded one of its 9 official languages as, quote, foreign, unquote. This despite the fact that Afrikaans originated in South Africa and is spoken by millions of indigenous people in the country. International cultural organizations such as UNESCO or the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization have also long considered Afrikaans to be an African language. Darren Taylor reports.
When Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first democratically elected president in 1994, he embraced Afrikaans, even though it was the language of apartheid's architects, the people who'd locked him up for 27 years.
This hut of the sin wore on some out word. Egadare noch mehare.
Mandela gave several speeches in Afrikaans and said he loved it. However, his reconciliatory stance was hard to accept for millions of black South Africans who'd suffered at the hands of mostly Afrikaans white racists. Down the years, more than a few of Mandela's fellow African National Congress, or ANC, members have declared Afrikaans to be a European tongue. They insist it originated in the mouths of white Dutch invaders. Now, Education Minister Blade Nzimande appears to have been angered by a constitutional court ruling that he reinstate Afrikaans as a language of teaching at the University of South Africa.
The court stressed that references to Afrikaans as a white man's language are erroneous and inconsistent with history.
Andre Gaum is a member of the South African Human Rights Commission.
Whilst acknowledging that Afrikaans was undeniably employed as a tool of oppression in the past, the court continued to recognize that the language has now been adopted into a heterogeneous rainbow language spoken by many South Africans, the majority of which are black people, and thus it is indeed deserving of protection and promotion in our country.
Linguist and Afrikaans language activist Donnie van Wyk says Nzimande and others in the ANC should be clever enough to know the truth about Afrikaans.
Words like brood, which is the Afrikaans for bread, comes from Malaysia. It was used, brought here by the slaves. So you have this interaction between slave and, of course, the colonist, and that is how the language was established and how it was originated. Afrikaans is spoken like...
He says Afrikaans began evolving from the moment Portuguese explorers and their slaves arrived in the Cape in the 1400s.
This is the only language one can say which actually bears the name of the continent Afrikaans. Afrikaans is an indigenous language, as is the Kokerboom, as is the Protea flower, as is the Fynbos. We do not know which formula the minister and his advisors used to come to a decision that Afrikaans is not an indigenous language. We would really like to know that, but we don't.
Afrikaans is the first language of the overwhelming majority of South Africa's 5 million plus coloured or mixed race citizens. Many black South Africans, including in the ANC, don't consider coloured to be black enough to be indigenous. Van Wyk says this is pure discrimination and such attitudes are racist.
Afrikaans has been politicized and has been stigmatized by the apartheid regime. Afrikaans is the language which belongs to the people. It is part of your identity. It is part of your culture. To deny this is an infringement of my constitutional rights as well as my human rights.
There's also a political undertone in play when ANC politicians make anti-Afrikaans statements. Most of its speakers live in the Western Cape province, which traditionally supports the opposition Democratic Alliance. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Calling it an abomination to grant bail to corruption, murder and other capital offence suspects, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says he will revamp the system. This comes after some suspects, mainly from the opposition, were arrested in a dramatic ways after being freed on bail. As reporter Maguma Davis Rakwaringi reports from Kampala, Uganda, some analysts believe denial of bail may be used to witch hunt political opponents.
Museveni said he has received reports of mob justice because people are dissatisfied with the way justice is administered. He said his government cannot just watch as suspected offenders walk scot-free. Museveni called bail for serious offences as contrary to traditional way of administering justice.
It must be a life for a life. This is the way our people understand justice in the villages. This is the way we, the freedom fighters, understand it. So I'm very ready to engage with the judiciary, but we're also going to take it up politically, to constitutionally, to see. Because it is going to cause us a lot of problems. It's very dangerous. It's a very big provocation. The judges must be very careful. They are playing in a very dangerous area here, which we cannot accept.
The president was this past weekend speaking on an occasion to remember the brutal murder of Uganda's first post-independence Chief Justice, Benedicto Kiwanuka, who was killed on orders of then-president Idi Amin Dada. The president's comments followed the dramatic arrest of two opposition MPs subscribing to national unity platform NUP, which is headed by former presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. Local media reported this yesterday as the president met with ruling party legislators to discuss the way forward regarding bail. Sarah Birete, who heads local NGO Center for Constitutional Development, tells VOA that application for bail is a fundamental right provided for by both international and local laws.
He's violating the principles of separation of powers, which is a basic doctrine in our constitution, as well as the independence of the judiciary as a third arm of government. It's an abuse of court's powers. It's an abuse of the independence of the judiciary.
She says the president is undermining judges' ability to exercise their constitutional powers and authority. Lawyer and opposition politician Benjamin Katana tells VOA that the president has bad motives.
Imagine if there is no recourse to bail and you have someone charged with a capital offense and the trial takes about 5 years and then eventually it is discontinued or the state just loses interest in it. What is the remedy of such a person that has been in jail for over 5 years? So we believe that it's part of the grand scheme to suppress and punish political opponents, and it is in no way brought in good faith to deepen and smoothen administration of justice in this country.
Chief Justice Alphonse Owinyi-Dolo said at the Benedicto Kiwanuka Memorial that the executive branch should respect court decisions.
We know that capital offences of whatever nature is of grave concern to the community. So in the exercise of judicial discretion to grant bail, it is the duty of a judicial officer to look at all these circumstances and boldly, without fear or favor, make the decision whether to grant or not to grant.
Owinyi-Dolo says the judiciary will consult with the president on this contentious matter. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinyi, Kampala, Uganda.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And Thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.